Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30. 1907 was a big year for Ireland's criminal.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fraternity. One of the world's most famous criminal couples, the Longford-born Marianne Dignan, better known as Chicago May, and the Irish-American Eddie Gearan, were back in the news. The two had risen to fame back in 1901 when they were caught robbing the American Express office in Paris. While Chicago May had been sent to a French prison, Gearan had been sentenced to what was called the dry guillotine. Known as Devil's Island, this prison was in effect a death sentence. 68,000 of the 70,000 people imprisoned there died during their sentence. However, Gearan would become world famous when he defied this statistic in spectacular form. In 1905, he became one of an elite few to escape Devil's Island and live to tell the tale. In 1906, he had moved to London, where he was reunited with Chicago May. However, after he violently abused her, she reported him to the authorities, leading to a French attempt to extradite Gearan back to France and Devil's Island. However, using his Irish ancestry, which at the time made him a British subject, Gearan managed to beat the extradition charge in 1907. This would pave the way for what became the next round in the Chicago May and Eddie Gearan saga. Gearan was only out of prison and the media spotlight a few weeks when Chicago May, now terrified of Gearan, arranged an assassination attempt. He was shot but did survive, and in a dramatic testimony, he would secure a 15-year prison sentence for his one-time accomplice, lover and would-be assassin, Chicago May. Now, by the end of the trial, the two were the most well-known criminals on the planet at the time. Chicago May was called the most notorious woman in Europe. Unsurprisingly, their exploits would lead to several books. However, in terms of Irish criminal history, they were superseded in a matter of weeks by news emanating from the south of France. This would see another Irishman sentenced to the dry guillotine of Devil's Island. In the early hours of August 6, 1907, the night train from Monte Carlo arrived in the French port of Marseille. Among the passengers to disembark were a middle-aged couple, Mr. and Mrs. Javeland. Struggling to carry a heavy travel trunk, they secured the assistance of a porter, leaving instructions that the luggage should be sent on ahead to London. The couple then retired to the prestigious Hotel de Louvre in Marseille. However, within a few hours, one of the most sensational and brutal crimes of the 20th century came to light. As staff in Marseille train station went about their business, they were increasingly overpowered by an obnoxious odour emanating from the travel trunk. On closer inspection, blood was seen oozing from the bottom of the case and pooling on the floor. An official was dispatched to the Hotel de Louvre to demand the Javelands return to the station and open the trunk. When they reached the train station, the couple were greeted by railway officials and the police. The trunk was opened and the assembled crowd recoiled in horror. They found themselves staring at the disarticulated and mutilated body of a woman. Her head and lower legs were missing. Over the following hours, the police in Marseille began to interrogate the Javelins and quickly learned this was a false identity. The true identities would lead the story back to Ireland, given the man pretending to be Mr. Javeland was none other than Vere Thomas St. Leger Gould. That was a name people of a certain age in Ireland at the time recognised. Although he hadn't been seen or heard of in years, Vere Gould had once been something of a minor celebrity in Ireland. Born into a minor aristocratic family, he had risen to fame as Ireland's first tennis champion and something of a poster boy for the sport as it emerged before he disappeared. How he found himself travelling through the south of France in 1907 with a disarticulated body in a suitcase is an intriguing and fascinating story. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Now, after last week's episode on the disappearance of Arthur Poole, this show is another that falls into the historic true crime genre, although we will also be covering lots of things along the way, like where tennis in Ireland came from, the decline of Ireland's aristocracy, and probably my favourite part of the case, the history of the Devil's Island penal colony. This notorious prison has intrigued me for years, so this episode gave me a chance to explore it in greater detail. Now, next week, we'll be changing tack completely with the first of two episodes on the Great Hunger. The first one is on groundbreaking new research about the famine Irish in New York, and my guest is Professor Tyler Anbinder. He was on the show before, and he has fascinating insights and research, so we'll be talking about that next week. Then the week after, I have a long show that I've been writing over the last few weeks about what we should call the famine in the 21st century. It's an issue that's increasingly embroiled in culture wars and something I get a lot of feedback about, so I'm going to give my views on that. And finally, before we kick off today's episode, don't forget to check out the shop. I have a 30% sale off everything running at the moment. All you have to do is go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and use the coupon code SALE30. That's irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and the code is SALE30. If you've been eyeing up anything in the shop, now is the time to get it. As I explained last week, the shop is about to change a lot in the coming months, and lots of the current merch won't be available after that change has happened. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and use that code SALE30 to get 30% off everything. Sound on the show is by Kate Dunlea. Vere Thomas St. Leger Gould was exposed as a brutal fraud in Marseille in 1907, but he had set out on this road decades earlier. Although born into a wealthy family, Gould always harboured impossibly high expectations of what life would deliver for him. Combined with a profound laziness, this was never going to end well. This is not to say he was always destined to end up in the most notorious prison in the world. Indeed, his youth did offer him a better start than most. I feel I'm getting ahead of myself here, so let's go right back to the start of Vere Gould's life. Now, although he was born in the County Tipperary town of Clonmel, Gould grew up in Waterford, where his father, George Gould, was a magistrate. While the family were comparatively well off on an island where many lived hand to mouth, there was no question the Goulds were a family that were clearly in rapid decline. Only a few generations earlier, the family had been extremely wealthy aristocrats. His great-grandfather on his mother's side was the Earl of Kenmare, while his father's family held the title of Baronet. As recently as his grandfather's day, they had possessed extensive estates which stretched across thousands of acres in East Cork and the surrounding counties. This also included multiple mansions. But the Great Hunger had more or less bankrupted the Gould family. While his uncles still possessed the aristocratic title of baronet, the estate and grand houses had all been sold in the early 1850s. Now, some of Vera Gould's siblings had been able to adapt to these changed circumstances. His brother James, for example, had joined the British Army and eventually settled in Australia. Knowing there was very little money left in the family, he would make a life for himself working on railroads. But Vere maintained an illusion of wealth. Although afforded an education, he proved himself a man of very limited ability. However, in the 1870s, he did gain temporary fame and a celebrity status few enjoyed through the game of tennis. Now, prior to the 1870s, the game commonly called tennis was pretty different to the modern sport. Sometimes called real tennis, it was played on an indoor court and its complex rules left it a pretty marginal game. However, in the 1870s, a new game known as lawn tennis was developed in England. It simplified and adapted the rules of real tennis so it could be played on lawns and cricket pitches. The new game spread rapidly and gained traction among the aristocracy and wealthy of Britain. Within a year or two, it had spread to Ireland. References to tennis first appeared in Irish newspapers in the late summer of 1874. This was the time of the year when wealthy Anglo-Irish families returned from what was called the season in London, a period of parties and balls that traditionally drew to a close in June, so presumably they had brought what was the latest craze in England with them back to Ireland. Now, by 1875, shops in Dublin were already stocking tennis equipment, and in August of that year, a meeting was convened in Kilkenny to form the first formal tennis club on the island. Now, while he had struggled in life up to this point, Vere Gould discovered that he had what might be called a natural aptitude for this new game of tennis. Indeed, he quickly emerged as something of a poster boy for a sport that spread quickly among the wealthy in Ireland in the 1870s. His entertaining, aggressive style of play, matched by good looks and a degree of charisma, made him an ideal advocate for this game. Meanwhile, given that tennis was synonymous with the wealthy, his family links to the aristocracy only added an air of grandeur to Gould, even if he had very limited wealth to back up his aristocratic claims. But there's no question Gould was an excellent tennis player. He was representing County Waterford even before the first club had been formed in the county in 1878. Indeed, he garnered a reputation as Ireland's best player, a fact seemingly confirmed when he won the first Irish tennis championship the following year of 1879. Buoyed on by this victory, he travelled to England that same year of 1879 to play at Wimbledon, which he was actually expected to win. He comfortably reached the final, where in front of 1,000 people, he was defeated by a Yorkshire vicar, John Hartley. Despite being hungover, he did still manage to win a second place playoff though that year. Now, his success continued into the 1880s. Although suffering from an injury, he led Ireland to victory in the first international between England and Ireland. Now, while Gould seemed poised to dominate tennis for years to come, the sport was not professional and couldn't offer him an income. But given it was exclusively played by the wealthy, it did give him connections and status he always craved. However, if the 1870s were marked by success in Vere Gould's life, things took a very different trajectory in the 1880s. While the Gould family had the pretensions of aristocratic wealth and title, the family in reality had very little to support such a lifestyle by the 1880s. In November 1879, Vere Gould's father George died, and his will laid bare the family finances. On his death, George Gould's assets amounted to less than £1,000. Now, while this was a considerable amount of money, when it was divided between his surviving children, it wasn't a life-altering sum. Therefore, through the early 1880s, Vere did secure work in what was one of the very few jobs he ever appears to have held down in his life, when he took up a position in a subdivision of the Ordnance Survey Office in Dublin. He did remain a very active member of the prestigious Fitzwilliam Tennis Club in these years, but by 1883, at the age of 30, he appears to have disappeared from the tennis scene. While Irish tennis would go on to dominate the world game briefly in the 1890s with wins at major international tournaments and the first Olympics, Vere Gould's life was on a very, very different trajectory by this point. He had once been a pretty celebrated figure. He had enjoyed minor celebrity status at one point, and his movements were even recorded in the society pages of newspapers. But by the middle of the 1880s, as I say, he had more or less disappeared, as his life increasingly seems to have been consumed by alcoholism. Now, in 1890, he did resurface, but this time in London, where he would meet a woman who would change his life. This was Mary Violet Girondin. These two people would prove a lethal combination. How exactly Vere Goold met Marie Girondin would become the subject of intense debate years later, but it appears he may have responded to a classified ad she took out in a newspaper in 1890 looking for a prospective husband. Now, Marie Girondin's life was surrounded in myth and rumour. She had been born in France but emigrated to England at a relatively early age. She claimed then to have emigrated to India, where she married a British army officer who died, leaving her a widow. Now, unlike Goold, Girondin in the 1880s was not afraid of hard work, and rather than squander the wealth that had been left to her, she moved to London and opened a high-class dressmaker's in Bayswater in the city. By the time she married Vere Goold in 1891, Girondin's business was successful, and in terms of their marriage, it was she who brought the most to the table. Indeed, what, if anything, Vere Goold brought to the marriage at this point is unclear. After the couple married in the summer of 1891, it does appear that Marie Girondin was the only one who earned an income. An acquaintance in these years would later say that Goold only, in her words, kept house and did the accounts. Reading between the lines, it seems that Girondin worked and Vere Goold drank and gambled the proceeds. This may explain why Girondin's business, once regarded as successful, went into decline, and by the end of the 1890s, the couple actually emigrated to Canada, leaving a series of deaths in their wake. This would start them on a road that would end in a Marseille train station in 1907.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Irish History today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Irish History. Now in Montreal, Marie Girondin opened a new dressmaking business that prospered initially at least. However, the New York Times would later interview Charlotte Schranz, an employee who revealed that Vere Goold was a serious alcoholic and gambler, with a view of himself that was completely divorced from reality. By the late 1890s, his uncle, the Baronet, had died without an heir, and his title had passed to Gould's older brother. But when Vere was drunk, he frequently bragged he was an aristocrat. Marie Girondin, who kept her own name after the marriage, appears to have enjoyed this aristocratic pretense, and increasingly, as time went on, she joined her husband in his bouts of drinking and gambling. Inevitably, the business in Montreal, which had once been moderately successful, could not keep a pace with the couple's expensive lifestyle. They began to travel to Europe, leaving their employee, Charlotte Schranz, to run the business and forward the profits to them. In Europe, they would brag to people about their successful business exploits in Montreal and Toronto, and that their visits to Europe were only business deals. Already living something of a fantasy, they began to use the title of Sir and Lady Gould. This followed the news that Vere's older brother, the Baronet, had died. Vere then claimed he was the next in line, and the couple couldn't resist pointing out to newspapers that she was now on a par with women who were once her clients. The reality of their lives was very different. Indeed, as the 20th century opened, the couple's life together began to disintegrate on every level. In 1901, a certain James Gould, Vere's older brother, who was a railroad worker in Australia, read in a newspaper about his brother claiming the family title. Irritated by this, he informed the press that the title was actually his by right, and Vere had even offered him £100 for it. Vere Gould's desperation to have this aristocratic title demonstrated he and his wife Marie were just living in a fantasy world, completely divorced from reality. Financially, they were also facing ruin. By 1902, they were spending less and less time in Canada and had actually relocated to the city of Liverpool, where they briefly opened a laundry. In what was becoming their modus operandi, this business failed and the couple ran up huge debts in the city. In late 1904, they briefly returned to Montreal, and their employee, Charlotte Schranz, would later recall how they were increasingly financially desperate, concocting wild schemes. Vere Gould, a chronic alcoholic and gambler by this point, told Schranz he had devised a scheme by which he could work a roulette table, and he intended to, in his words, break the bank in Monte Carlo, a famous gambling destination by this point. Meanwhile, their only real source of income, that dressmaking business in Montreal, collapsed in another pile of debts around 1904. By January 1905, the now essentially bankrupt couple made the bizarre decision to relocate to Monte Carlo. Situated in the Principality of Monaco, on the French Riviera, the city-state was the playground of Europe's elite and one of the most expensive places to live on the continent. However, Vere Gould appears to have deluded himself that he was finally going to make a fortune on roulette tables there, but this was never going to end well. After moving to Monte Carlo, the couple spent their last savings on a house, but continued to live far beyond their means and hired someone to clean and cook for them. Unusually, they did pay their bills, initially at least. Now, Gould's scheme to make a fortune at roulette obviously didn't work, and by 1907, the pair were already in dire straits. They were reduced to petty scams. Gould would swindle £50 from a woman who he pledged to marry. In May of that year, 1907, Marie Girondin was accused of stealing 300 francs, the equivalent of £12, from another woman in the city. They were also pressurising Girondin's niece, who lived with them, to borrow money from waiters in the city. By July 1907, they were in such dire straits that they dismissed their staff because they couldn't afford to keep someone to cook for them. Increasingly, other people in Monte Carlo became wary of the couple, who they viewed as con artists. When they increasingly befriended a wealthy Danish widow, Emma Levin, her friends warned the woman to be wary of the couple. Levin, in many ways, was a perfect target for Gould and Girondin by this point. She was extremely wealthy and always keen to demonstrate this. She often wore expensive jewellery and spoke openly about her wealth. In July 1907, she would make the fatal error of loaning Vere Gould and Marie Girondin money. On August 5th, 1907, Vera Gould and Marie Girondin left Monte Carlo somewhat abruptly. They didn't hide the fact they were going, but it seemed somewhat unplanned to other people in the city. Taking the night train across the south of France, they alighted in Marseille train station. This was a common route taken by travellers heading towards London. As we heard at the start of the podcast, this is where everything unravelled. After leaving their travel trunk under a false name, Mr. and Mrs. Javeland, with instructions to forward it to London, they had retired to a hotel. However, within a few hours, porters had noticed blood oozing from the trunk, and when it was opened, the authorities found the disarticulated and mutilated body of Emma Levin inside. A search of the couple's hotel room would later find the missing body parts in their hand luggage. To seal a case against Gould and Girondin, if any further evidence was needed, the couple were also found to be in possession of the dead Danish woman's jewellery. Now, Gould and Girondin, fantasists at the best of time, tried to explain away the compelling evidence against them with pretty ludicrous stories. The pair, never criminal masterminds, tried to claim they scarcely knew the dead woman, but she had turned up at their residence in Monte Carlo to ask for a loan. Then they claimed a man, her supposed lover, had rushed into the house, shot Emma Levin twice at point-blank range, and then ran away, leaving Gould and Girondin with the corpse. They did admit to dismembering the body, but this was only because they claimed they wanted to avoid controversy. Now, all this ludicrous story did was to confirm in the minds of the Marseille police there was a more nefarious explanation to what had happened. As Girondin and Gould underwent repeated interrogations, the press that surrounded this case was sensational from the outset. Indeed, the very day that they were arrested, the story was transmitted across Europe via telegrams. The suspects were initially called Good and the deceased woman called Levy, and initially it was said that Gould and Girondin were English. So the evening newspapers in Britain that same day were carrying numerous stories about the case. Now, in the following days, the real names and identities emerged, and Irish newspapers began to print details of Vera Gould's former life and the well-known people he had once known. Meanwhile, in France, newspapers like Le Petit Journal published graphic and ghoulish sketches of the body in the case. Almost immediately, a narrative surrounding the case emerged that presented Marie Girondin as the mastermind. She was portrayed as a conniving and calculating wife who controlled Vera Gould's every move. He, on the other hand, was depicted as a pretty dim and helpless alcoholic. Girondin had played her part, but there's little evidence that she was the one who had driven the two to carry out the desperate act in Monte Carlo. As we will see later, the prosecution did have legal reasons to support this narrative, but misogyny and anti-French sentiment created a willing audience for this in the British press. Ultimately, details remained sketchy until the case went to court in December 1907. In a trial in Monte Carlo, it emerged that Vera Gould had more or less admitted that he killed Emma Levin. He and Marie Girondin would claim that she was entirely innocent of the murder itself and only participated in dismembering the body. Now, they may have come up with this defence because the stakes of the trial couldn't have been higher. Murder, when accompanied by a secondary crime such as theft, carried the death sentence, and in 1907, the guillotine was still in use in Monaco. However, the prosecution were certain, because of the multiple wounds Emma Levin had suffered, that two people had been involved in the murder. This perhaps explained why they focused most of their case on Marie Girondin and tried to present her as the criminal mastermind. They were pretty certain they could convict Vera Gould, given he had admitted to the crime, but they really needed to show that Marie Girondin was involved. The couple never fully admitted what had happened to Emma Levin. When she arrived at the house, she was given a drink by Girondin, and Gould hit her over the head 3 times. When this failed to kill her, it seems that he and Girondin stabbed the woman multiple times. Now, with Vera Gould admitting his involvement and his conviction more or less secure, as I say, the trial became a relentless campaign to depict Marie Girondin as the mastermind, and she was presented in the worst light possible. every aspect of her character came under attack. The prosecution would introduce stories or rumours that she had had love affairs with multiple men in her native village, while letters were produced that suggested the couple had had a sexual relationship before they were married. It was even insinuated that Marie Girondin might have been a sex worker. What this had to do with the murder is unclear, but it served as a general attempt to destroy her character. Indeed, Vere Goold himself was presented as a pretty unintelligent man who had become a hapless alcoholic enthralled to Marie. Playing on biases in society at the time, his aristocratic background was also presented to stand in stark contrast to Girondin's more modest family upbringing. Now, that she was a mastermind just doesn't really stand up, though, in my mind, given the life that the two had lived. She was the one who had earned the money that he had gambled and drank away in the early years of their marriage. This is not to say that Girondin was not guilty of playing a role in the murder. She clearly had been actively involved, but the prosecution went way over the top to secure a conviction against her. Now, what was never really revealed was a level of premeditation. There was strong evidence that the two hadn't ever really planned to kill Emmett Levin. Windows in the house were left open and neighbours were able to testify that they had heard screams. Then again, this pair proved themselves to be of pretty limited intelligence when it came to planning crimes. Their attempt to dispose of Emma Levin's body by transporting it back to England was nothing short of bizarre. Ultimately, the prosecution had a solid case. Aside from the character assassination, the hard evidence was pretty convincing. They had a body, the weapons used at the scene, witnesses to support their case, and they would end their argument by calling for the death sentence of both Vere Goold and Marie Girondin. Ultimately, the judgment would fall slightly short of this. Marie Girondin, considered the mastermind, was handed a death sentence due to be delivered by guillotine. She would utter the words, "C'est terrible," it's terrible in French, in reaction to this verdict. Vere Goold, for his part, received the somewhat lesser-sounding sentence of penal servitude for life. However, this would, in time, prove the harsher of the two fates they suffered. Marie Girondin appealed her death sentence, and this was eventually commuted to life in a female prison in Montpellier. Meanwhile, Goold would serve his sentence in what was known as the Dry Guillotine, the notorious French prison colony of Devil's Island. In July 1908, he was placed onto a transport and shipped across the Atlantic to French Guiana, the tiny French colony in South America. While Devil's Island was the name used to describe the prison, it was actually a prison colony situated on multiple islands and the mainland of French Guiana. With the reputation of being one of the worst prisons in the world, Devil's Island lived up to this name. The conditions were appalling. The food rations were meagre and disease was rampant. If you're familiar with the book or the movie Papillon, it's set in this prison. But the reality seems to have been far worse than any of the fictional depictions that have come out over the last century. As I mentioned at the beginning, the vast majority, over 95% of prisoners incarcerated on Devil's Island, died before the end of their sentence. While the Irish-American convict who we met at the start of the show, Eddie Guerin, had managed to escape in 1905, Vere Goold had little chance of repeating this. Guerin had been fit and healthy and in his 40s and an extremely fit man. Goold was 10 years older, but his alcoholism had ravaged his body. The young, agile athlete who had dominated tennis in the 1870s was now an overweight, bearded man who looked really unhealthy. The rigours of an escape through the jungles of French Guiana were far beyond him. Ultimately, he would survive for just 1 year in the prison. In 1909, he would take his own life on what was the anniversary of his Irish tennis championship win 3 decades earlier. Marie Girondin would outlive him for a few years. In January 1914, she died in Montpellier jail. That's where I'm going to leave this episode. Next week, we're on to a completely different topic, and that's about the survivors of the Great Hunger in New York and some pretty surprising new evidence about their lives there. So until then, Sloan.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.